Good morning. I'd like to present some of the early results from the Kepler mission for the Kepler team. First place I like to start always is, what is it the mission trying to accomplish? And so here basically are the questions we're striving to answer. Certainly the frequency of Earth-sized planets in and near the habitable zone is number one. We'd like to determine, in fact, ATIS of Earth. We'd like to know for these planets their distribution of semi-major axes, their sizes. We'd like to understand what we find around not only single stars, but multiple star systems. And certainly we'll be seeing a lot of planets that are giant planets, and we'd like to understand those. In particular, since we stare at many of these stars for years at a time, we'd like to get at their albedos, and we think we can do that. And finally, what we'd like to do is associate whatever we find with the characteristics of the stars themselves, their metallicity, their masses, their temperatures, and to some extent their ages. Kepler really has three separate coordinated efforts. We have the core objectives, address the mission goals. We do have some participating scientists that have joined the team to help us with various aspects of the research on exoplanets. There's an astroseismology group, the Kepler Astroseismic Science Consortium, which is mostly in Europe, but has something of the order of 300 members who look at all these stars, both in long cadence, and we have several hundred that they look at in short cadence as well. The idea here is to give us the size of the stars and their ages, as well as investigate the structure and evolution of many of these stars. We also have a guest observer program. We have just finished the second selection of guest observer program proposals. The first group of about 10 looked at such things as white dwarfs, star spots, active galactic nuclei, and in fact are trying to put our Kepler magnitude scale on an absolute photometric scale. A review of the instrument. Basically, it is a wide field of view photometer. It has precision sufficient to find Earth-sized planets. Its internal noise is about 10 parts per million. Transit of an Earth across a star like the Sun is 80 parts per million. If you add in 10 parts per million for shot noise and stellar variability, you find that we ought to be able to do about 20, 25 parts per million for 12th magnitude stars and get signal noise ratios about 3 or 4 per transit, which means we need at least 3 or 4 transits to find some of these targets or to identify some of the Earth-sized planets. We need, since we're trying to find planets in the habitable zone of stars like the Sun, we need to observe for several years, 3 or 4 years at least, before we get enough transits to say indeed we have a definite Earth analog. Clearly, for the later stars, which have lower masses, cooler temperatures, the orbital periods for the habitable there are shorter. If we get an extended mission, we'd like to continue to look at the same area of the sky, the same stars, because the habitable zone of stars hotter than the Sun are generally with periods of the order of 2 years or better, and so a 6-year mission would allow us to understand the habitable zone of stars for some of the F stars, for example. System is in heliocentric orbit, which is different than the Corot orbit. It should be a lot easier for us to avoid we won't have some of the problems associated with the radiation belt that causes so many discontinuities that Magali showed. It also allows us to look at the same group of stars continuously, 24 hours a day, 365 days every year. So we miss many fewer transits that way, and certainly it's much easier for us to get orbital periods of a year or longer and get 3 or more transits. But this system allows us to look at 170,000 stars with long cadence and an additional 512 stars with a short 1-minute cadence. The latter is generally used to measure the ingress and egress time of the transits or to look for planets around eclipsing binaries, and certainly to look at dwarfs with astroseismology to get at the density and size and age of those stars. To get statistically valid results with transit photometry, we need a lot of stars to look at. We look at 156,000 stars at the current time. That will decrease as the spacecraft moves away from the sun, away from the Earth, and our telemetry rate falls. We expect always to be able to look at least 100,000 stars. The field of view of active silicon on the sky is about 100 square degrees. The diameter of our field of view is closer to 15, but of course there's a lot of dead space between our CCDs. What we see on the right there is the system that does the job for us. It's basically a Schmidt-designed telescope, 1 meter corrector, 1.4 meter primary mirror, focal plane here with 95 million pixels. The electronics to convert it to digital signals is here, and of course the signal goes to the spacecraft then. We do not generally send images back, although we do that twice each month. Generally we send back just the pixels for each of our stars. So we do our photometry on the ground, and that helps a great deal because we can do it in several different ways, and as people find better methods, they can reprocess the data and do even better than we have done. This is a picture of the spacecraft just before launch. What you see is the telescope. You see the instrumentation, the spacecraft itself with the navigation equipment, transmitters, batteries, and here's the high gain antenna, which we use to transmit our data down once a month. The focal plane is shown here. We have some 42 CCDs, two outputs on each CCD, so we have 84 channels. Each pair of CCDs is in a module cut with a sapphire lens. Because the focal plane is so large, we have to flatten that to focus focus the image on the CCDs. In each case, we have four little CCDs that actually track stars on the focal plane, so we actually track, so for over a period of 3 months, we can actually keep the same stars on the same pixel, generally the same center of the star on the same pixel the entire time, even though there's differential aberration as this thing moves through space. The throughput looks like this. Basically, we cut out about 430 nanometers, cut out at 890 nanometers. The cut here at 430 is to get rid of the calcium H and K lines. They're often quite variable in stars. We don't want variable stars. We want noise. And so we cut out all the ultraviolet. The observations I'm going to talk about today are basically the first set of observations. Most of what we'll be talking about today are the first 10 days of our observations. During our 65-day commissioning period, we had 10 days where we could actually look at a group of stars in our field of view. We simply took everything, all the dwarfs, all the giants, and used that to quickly go to our telescopes, because that was the middle of our observing season. Our stars generally set by the time October rolls around, and by the time commissioning was finished, we were well into this observing season. So we took these early groups of stars, found some bright ones, and started looking. Science operations began a few weeks later on 12th of May, and since we now knew where our target stars lay on the pixels, we can now use a smaller group of pixels for each star, and so now we move from 56,000 stars to monitoring 156,000 stars. Of these, we do monitor something of the order of 1,000 red giants because we do astrometry. Astrometry allows us to do parallax, and parallax gives us, with the photometry and effective temperatures, the size of the stars. That's very important. You're going to get the size of the planets. We're also looking at some variable stars to do astroseismology, and some 450 stars where we're looking for where we are monitoring planets that we knew in our field of view to get the ingress-egress times, eclipsing binaries, and stars for astroseismology. As the seasons go on, we decrease the number of stars for astroseismology and put more of them into looking at exoplanets in terms of their ingress and egress time, so we can do timing on the many exoplanets and eclipsing binaries. So what I'm going to show you here is basically 43 days worth of data, But mostly the data based on those 10 days, backed up with some data on the next 33 days. We found over 300 candidate planets with that data. Many of these are, of course, eclipsing our false positives. So clearly, we've got a lot of work to do. As Magali mentioned, there's a great deal of processing that goes through before you can say, I've got a planet instead of false positive. Gaspar was also talking about the amount of work that's required to sort out the real stars from the eclipsing binary. So we'll talk about only what we've been able to find and confirm. We've also have hundreds of eclipsing binaries, close to 1,000, and thousands of variable stars, and we'll show some of that work as well. This is a figure that was shown yesterday, but I think it's worth looking at again. It's the HETP7 data. We can see the transit very clearly. We can see occultation. When we expand that scale, we can see light from the star. That light from that star, of course, is the first thing that's been discovered. The dip here is about 80 parts per million. As I mentioned, that's the dip that you expect from transiting Earth. And so that proves the instrument does have the precision to find Earth-sized planets. Since that time, our co-eyes have taken the data, taken more data, and have binned the data, and that's shown down here. So this data is this data here near the occultation. The red boxes are, I believe, about 1 hour bins. And what you see here is something a little bit different than what you saw up there, where the light, the curve comes continuously up and then falls dramatically at the occultation. Here, when you look more closely, it comes up, but just before the occultation occurs, it begins to decrease again. Then the occultation, some increase, and then the decrease. And our co-eyes are explaining that by saying several things are happening here, and it's the convolution of all these. Certainly, as the planet comes around the back of the star to Superior Conjunction, we're seeing a rise in the brightness of the light from that star. But the planet is so close, it's within four diameters of the star, that it distorts the star. So at occultation, you're actually seeing the star with a minimum cross-section. It's sort of football-shaped, and that football is pointed towards you at that time, so the light from the star is decreasing here. So basically, it's more complex than we have made out, and it allows people to begin to understand some of the properties of the star and possibly of the tide the planet raises on the star. One of the things that, again, Gaspar mentioned and Magali mentioned is our concern with false positives. It's sort of almost a paranoid concern for many of us. And that, of course, people, when they first started finding these planets, would come, make a discovery, and come to the next meeting and say, well, it wasn't a discovery, it was a mistake on my part. We're trying to avoid that. So we have this real interest in making sure we don't talk about things that are false positives. Here's an example of something that we almost announced in January. We have a very nice light curve with very regular transits. When we detrend that, we see this curve here. Again, nice set of transits. A gap here between the 10 days of data during commissioning, the 33 days of data during the first part of the science operations. Beautiful light curve when it's folded. You can see the limb darkening beautifully. No bumps or humps here. And if you look at 180 degrees where the occultation is, no secondary transit. No secondary transit means this is not an eclipsing binary. We got some radial velocity measurements here. The radial velocity measurements confirm the period, confirm the phase of the planet. A very, very nice curve here. And so we're really delighted with this. But part of our process is to go and do some active optics to make sure that there's not something hidden in the background. This is a measurement that we then made with active optics. The separation of those pair of stars is 3/10 of an arc second. Without active optics, those stars would have been merged. On the slit of a spectrograph, those stars are merged. And so we had to recognize that the dip of the transit is now being diluted by one of those two stars. We don't know which of the two stars, but it's being diluted. So we've got an inaccurate value for the size of the planet. We're not, at first we were not sure which of the two stars was the one that had the planet. And again, so we don't know the properties of the star either. So this did not get announced. It was considered a false positive, but it turns out that those data are pretty good, and we're still investigating that, and it may very well turn out to be something that we announce fairly shortly as a planet, because we'll have worked out which of the two stars it is. So in the hundreds of candidates we found several that were big enough, bright enough, so we could very quickly do the confirmation, even though there was very little time left in our first season for doing confirmation. The stars are shown here. The scale relative scale is correct. Even the smallest star here is quite a bit bigger than the Sun. That's 40% larger than the Sun, and this is 80% larger than the Sun. So these stars are all somewhat evolved stars. The temperatures run from about 5,600 to 6,300 Kelvin. What we see here are very nice transit shapes, very round. If they were triangular shaped, that would tell you immediately that this was a grazing binary, as Magali showed earlier. And a rather small dip here is that this is a planet quite a bit smaller than Jupiter. In this case, a planet the size of Neptune. Orbital periods are all very short because we always demand several transits before we even consider a confirmation. And much of this is based on those 10 days of observations. The orbital periods are very short, 3 days, 3.5 days. Our longest one that we confirmed was 5 days. For our confirmation here, we wanted to use radio velocity. The radio velocity looks very, very good here. Very tiny errors here, but this is a rather massive planet, twice the mass of Jupiter. And we see as we go further to the right and the masses become smaller that the error bars look larger. The error bars aren't larger, it's just that the scale is going from 200 meters a second, 50 meters a second, to much smaller values here. And when we get back down to planets like that of Neptune, we've got some 15 observations, and they're a confirmation, but they're not a great confirmation. Michel was talking about the fact when he does a confirmation, he likes to get 40 measurements. We can't afford 40 measurements. We have far too many candidates to do that. And the difficulty, of course, is this is a Neptune-mass planet. If we're talking about super-Earths, twice the size of the Earth, 1.5 times the size of the Earth, the size of the Earth, we're not going to be able to use radio velocity for those confirmations in general. We will have to exclude all other sources, but we're not going to see confirmations for Earth-sized planets using radio velocity. So validation of the discoveries is critical. And here's what we use currently. The red is what we will not use for the smallest planets. But basically, you first look at your data stream. Demand signal noise ratio for greater than 7 sigma, then rule out statistical fluctuations. 7 sigma occurs in white noise once every 10 billion times. And 10 billion is a reasonable number. You're looking at 10 to the fifth stars. You're shifting through 10 to the fifth phases. We want 3 or more transits to make sure we've got the orbital periodicity very accurately, to make sure it's very, very repetitive, gets rid of star spots. The light curve shape in particular is important to us. We need to see the limb darkening when the planet goes across the star. The duration needs to be consistent with a star of known size and the orbital period that we have measured. Then we look at, assuming it passed all those tests, then we do centroid motion. That is to say, if you look at the centroid of a particular star before the transit, you can see where the brightness center is. And then during the transit, if that moves, it means there is a background star that's changing the centroid movement, the centroid. And so we can recognize even very close background stars in that fashion. Assuming you pass these tests, then you look for astrophysical events, and you do that by doing radio velocity, medium precision with 3-meter telescopes, rule out stellar companions, which usually have velocities a few hundred meters a second. You go to high precision, you can get masses if the star is bright enough and the mass is large enough. And if you can't do that, you can play an upper limit on the masses. The Rossiter-McLaughlin effect again, which was shown yesterday, as something we can do occasionally, where even though you can't get the rate of velocity of the orbital motion, the rate of velocity change due to the limb motion of the star can sometimes be used to confirm that we have a planet. And finally, we do high spatial resolution to identify the close background stars. And another thing that we will be doing is calculate the uncertainty of a particular discovery by simply measuring the eclipsing binary frequency and getting that aerial density and then multiplying that by the area around the star that we can't check. Here are the planets that we have found. Earth, there's our Kepler 4b, Neptune size, Jupiter. Jupiter was considered to be one of the bigger planets you would find. More mass would simply increase density. But what we found are many of the stars, or many of the planets are bigger than Jupiter, have densities quite a bit less. Density of Jupiter, about 1.3. Some of these are 0.6, 0.3. And this one is 0.17, about one quarter the density of Jupiter, average density of styrofoam. Our planets are hot because the orbits are short. And we saw yesterday that 5B Heather was showing the 5B measurements with Spitzer and showing that we could actually see the occultation of 5B. It may be that they'll be able to see some of the other planets, but these planets are extremely hot, including 4B. One of the curves that I think is very interesting is to go plot the log of the planet density versus the planet mass. Theoretical curve is shown here. This is from Jonathan Fortney, and this is a hydrogen helium sphere. We can constantly add mass until it becomes a star. Our four planets are well below that in density, so the density is below hydrogen helium sphere, and these open circles are measurements by some of the other investigators here who have measured densities. So an interesting a problem for us to look at. We've been again trying to understand whether it could be a measurement problem. We don't see that. We actually looked at one of our stars that has a planet, one of these planets on it, and with both deducing the density from our measurements and deducing the density from astroseismology of that star, and they agreed quite well. So it's not obvious to us that, for example, the limb darkening problem, which was brought up yesterday, is a reason for this disagreement. But we're looking to see if there's any possibility that our measurements might be off. The other thing that's very interesting here is 4B, about the size and mass of Neptune. One of the things that's interesting here is that both of these, the 4B has a irradiation level of some 800,000 times that of Neptune. So you'd certainly expect from theory to expand that and have a very low density planet here. But that's not the case. So another interesting case that I think our colleagues who are interested in the structure of planets can use as a test. In the coming year, that is this year, now that our star field is beginning to rise, we should be able to confirm more planets, and we are expecting to begin to fill in this area with planets between Jupiter and Neptune, where we can do RV confirmations, and then begin to explore this region with a lot of the small candidates to get an idea of how this area varies. We certainly see lots of variable stars. Here are some stars oscillating, oscillation stop over a period of 10 days, start up again. Stars that are, I don't know whether this is a gamma derata star, but stars that are very evolved stars that have quite a bit of variability. A star here that's obviously an eclipsing binary, very V-shaped transits. One of the stars is oscillating, then stops, starts, stops again. Here, what we can see is it's very ragged. This foreground star is obviously the one that's oscillating. This is an eclipsing binary that's very asymmetric, very much like the Rossner-McLaughlin effect, but this would be considered the von Zippel effect because it's two stars where the spin axes are not aligned with the orbital axes. Another one of the objects in a background star, another star that's looked at, and this is a dwarf nova. We can see the quiescent periods, the various outbursts, a major outburst here, and during the quiescent periods we can see it oscillates. And during the outburst, we can see again oscillation somewhat different in magnitude and in a little bit different in period. So again, quite a bit of information here on some of the stars. One of the things that's important to us is try to understand the age of the stars. We get some of that from the astroseismology, but astroseismology for our system works basically with stars, at least for dwarfs, that are 11.5 magnitude and brighter. Many of our stars are dimmer than that, and so we'd like to get the ages not only of that, what you get with astroseismology, but anyway, any other way we can. And stars generally slow down. The rotation rates fall as they get older. So that's a way of getting at the age of field stars. And what we have is a relationship based basically on some young clusters here. And this, by the way, is temperature, and that is age, B minus V. This is hot, that's cold. And this is 0 to 10 gigayears. And this is the rotation rate of a star in days. The relationships that we have there are based on a few young clusters plus one data point from the sun. What we have are four clusters, four star clusters in our field of view, and that basically, those are shown in blue here, and so we ought to be able to define the surface of the evolution of the rotation rates as a function of age much better for our various star types than we have been able to before, and get at the ages of the stars that we find planets around. Astroseismology is doing beautifully. Ron Gilliland published a paper where these are stars in one of our clusters that are evolving off the main sequence. He simply looked at 10 large pulsations here and noticed that for this star it's 2 days, 3 days, 10 days, and 20 days, showing that as the star evolves, the pulsation rate changes in these systems. This is for acoustic modes, the P modes. They're very, very clear here. You can see the P modes here with the variation during the faculae and the granulation noise. And so the bumps show up very, very nicely. You can see these by eye. Here's that's pulled out very nicely. And you can do that basically by eye with a lot of these stars. In fact, when Hans Gjelsen looked at this, he said he just about cried. He'd never believed in his lifetime he would see data this clean, but that we have a lot of this. So we ought to be able to do some very nice understanding of the acoustic modes on these stars. When you do these searches, you find lots of interesting things. Magali showed you one thing that they had found that was a surprise, a density of a planet of 23. The density of the most dense metal that we know of is iridium. That's 19. What she found was 23. So quite an interesting discovery. What we have found here are some systems like this. We found several of them. The star oscillates. We see some nice transits. We plot the transits. Got the limb darkening. No bumps here. So it looks great. Except the occultation is much deeper than the transit by a factor of almost 3. Now the only way that can happen is that the planet is hotter than the star. Well, you can say, well, maybe this isn't really a planet. It's a white dwarf. But the mass is too low. And the size is too large. This is just about the size of Jupiter. White dwarfs are about the size of the Earth. So the temperature of the companion is about 12,000, stars about 9,000. So we're trying to understand how that can occur, and we have several of these. So lots of surprises. Let me summarize. In the next few years, we expected to determine the frequency of Earth-sized planets, whether Earth's habitable zone are common or rare, in other words, A to Earth. And if we find lots of planets in a habitable zone, what we expect is a follow-on missions may very well be designed around coronagraphs. If not, then we're going to have to look a lot deeper into space and possibly build an interferometer. Clearly, the most important thing, of course, is that we will determine the fate of Star Trek. Are there planets to go to or aren't there? So Kepler is an important step in the search for life in our galaxy. Thank you.
Questions, comments? That was beautiful. Westraub. Is there any reason to think that the sample of stars that you're looking at, which is at about a kiloparsec, is any different from the planet companion samples that we would expect in the solar neighborhood?
That's a good question. One of the difficulties, of course, is to pick a good distance to characterize this. Certainly the M-dwarfs, the several thousand M-dwarfs we look at, are all within 100 parsecs, so they're very close. But if you talk about the F-dwarfs, you know, they are several kiloparsecs, or maybe 10 kiloparsecs. So there's quite a range of distances we look at. I don't think that anybody has been able to show to expect a substantial difference in what we're looking at. We're looking at almost tangentially in the galactic distribution of stars. So we think what we see will be typical for the stars in the solar neighborhood.
Nick Cowan. So on page 12, you're talking about the different ways you reject false positives, and you mentioned that doing the very accurate RV would be impossible for most of the Earths that you're going to find. So if you want to nail down Eta Earth, at some point we're going to have to make a leap of faith that we can drop that one step and still get useful statistics. So can you give us an idea of, once you get to that stage, once you've called out all the kind of more obvious false positives, what fraction of those that you now send to accurate RV end up being false positives?
I don't know that we have a good number for that. So I really can't say. We haven't done enough of that at this point to give you a good answer for that.
Jim Casting, the theorists must have weighed in by now on what these hot objects are going around the star that are too small for white dwarfs or too not massive enough but too big. So, what are some ideas for what those objects?
Well, Jim, most theorists, as soon as they see any data that's unusual, can come up with at least two theories for it. Somebody was saying, in fact, there's often an overabundance of theories in this game. What they've come up with are a lot of really interesting ideas that are being explored. The one that I like the best is, imagine that you have an A star and a K star that start up together as a binary. The A star quickly evolves, expands into its Roche lobe, dumps all of its mass on the K star. So the K star then becomes an A star, because it's got lots of extra mass, but it's, of course, much older. In the meantime, the A star has lost its mass, and you're looking at its cooling core. Now, I don't know that this has any viability when you start looking at the time scales and the capture rates of the material from that atmosphere. But it's one of the ideas that was expressed, as an example.
Yeah. Yeah, I did a similar comment. I think there's probably many people who are aware of this, but there's some colleagues of mine at the University of Toronto, Martin Vankirk, Rick, Renee Breton, and also including Saul Rabbit.
Could you use a microphone, please, so everybody can hear?
And so they've suggested these objects are actually normally massed white dwarfs. And I guess they did a sort of novel analysis of the data where they suggested there was a basically a Doppler boosting of the brightness, and so they use that to infer that the radial velocities are actually quite large and consistent with white dwarf masses. So.
Okay.
Yeah, I was just gonna. Yeah, I actually refereed this paper. So, it's basically what Andrew said, and they also come up with evolutionary scenarios for how it could evolve to this state, and they find that these are perfectly plausible scenarios, and in fact, are even expected. The interesting thing, I think, is how common these things must be in order that Kepler has found two of them in the
We've
small sample of stars.
So you're right.
Yeah.
They're surprisingly common.
But by white dwarfs, they are bigger than most of the white dwarfs, et cetera, because they're degenerate objects, and for degenerate objects, lower mass means larger. And there's also the way of getting the mass by the ellipsoidal variations.
Lucy. did I hear you say that, Jeremy Goodman, sorry. Did I hear you say that most of the planets you discussed today are actually less dense than pure hydrogen helium planets? And if so, what entropy did you assume?
I'm sorry, I'm missing your question.
I thought I heard you say that most of your planets are actually less dense than a pure hydrogen helium.
That's correct.
What entropy did you, or age did you assume for that comparison?
Basically, of course, we simply measure density and can plot, put our points on that plot. Jonathan Fortney generated that curve, and Jonathan is here, and so he can probably give you a better idea as to the assumptions.
Okay.
Right.
Ruth Marie Clay, are you concerned that any of the choices that you're making to reject light curves that look strange or just to be conservative about detecting planets will affect the population statistics that you ultimately get out of the survey?
That's really a very excellent question. We can only look at a fraction of all the all the candidates. And so we need to understand how we choose those candidates and how much effort we spend to do a follow-up, because that will bias our results, and we recognize that.
Hi, I'm Henri Trio. I'd like to know how many stars are misaligned, like in the light curve you showed, and also how many planets, or for how many stars will you determine the real angle of the real spin of the star from asteroseismology, I suppose?
You're asking two questions.
Yeah.
The latter one was trying to determine the inclination of the stars from astroseismology. I don't know the answer to that. The astroseismologist, Tim is here. Maybe we can. You don't know the answer either. Tim is on the steering group for the Kepler Astroseismic Science Consortium. I really don't know that. You know, they've just begun getting their data. They've only had it for several months, although they're making excellent progress with it. But I don't know that we can answer that question at this point. It's just too early. And your first question? The stars that we have a light curve. Okay, that depends on the von Zippel effect, where you've got two stars that cross one another and cross, you know, one limb more than the other limb, and so you see the it's a hot, fast-rotating star. It expands. You come across that. If you hit the equator, it's hot. If you hit the poles, it's cool. And if you graze it, you can get this kind of change. How many have we done, or how many could we do? Well, we have a lot of hot, rotating stars that have candidates. We generally put those aside. For us to go and follow them up, make this measurement. Let's see, we want to be careful here. You're asking how many do we see that have the von Zippel effect? I don't know the answer to that.
Andrew Uden. So you showed us an interesting object that's possibly a planet in a binary. Can you tell us how tight that binary is? I think I saw it as a third of an arc second. And is Kepler actively pursuing planets in binary systems?
We're certainly actively pursuing planets around binary systems. We have a lot of those. We have one of the participating scientists is heading that effort up and building a catalog of the eclipsing binaries and starting to look for planets. The other question you really had was the Kepler object of interest that I showed. The person that's worked with that is Dave Latham. I don't know if we've determined that the two stars are in a physical system or just an optical system.
No, we don't have an orbit for the wide pair, but it corresponds to something more than 500 AU separation, so it's pretty wide.
Still have some time for more questions.
Matt Umerhan. I
I noticed in the very beginning you showed the light curve of the phase of induced by the planet orbiting, and you showed that there was a rise in the rise in the light coming from the primary star, suggesting that what you're seeing is a phase function, an effect due to the phase of the oblateness caused by the planet onto the primary star.
You're speaking of this curve.
Yes. Here. So has there been any calculations done, suggesting, establishing how much tidal distortion is being caused, and working backwards upon, doing the backward problem, establishing how much tidal distortion this corresponds to, and then seeing if that actually matches up with the mass of the planet. And so what is that then? Does that then work backwards?
Who is doing that? I'm sorry.
It is consistent. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. But in any case, I know people are looking into it, but sometimes they do the opposite. They look at the distortion and they calculate the mass of the planet. I know that's been done for the hot objects. That's how you get at the mass of that companion. But I don't know what's been done here.
My name is Ed van der Heuvel from Amsterdam. I would like to know, are you looking also at planets around early type stars, like B stars, late B stars perhaps, or A type stars?
We have not rejected looking at planets around these early stars. And so basically, if we see transits on any type star, we record them, put them in our catalog. But of course, B stars are very big. We don't have many in our field of view, so I don't know that we have any candidates at all for stars that early.
Alan Boss. Bill, at the very beginning you said that in the first 43 days of observations we had something like 300 planet candidates. The question is, are those candidates due to single transits or multiple transits? So what sort of periods? Are these all periods less than 43 days, or some of them could be longer than 43 days?
We certainly see a range of periods from less than a day, to periods where we see one transit, we look at the width of the transit, and we use that to estimate the orbital period. And of course, orbital periods go out, 6 months, a year, things like that. But with one transit, you really don't have a good estimate of the orbital periods.
Okay, that's the last question.
Well, Dave Spiegel, you might not want to comment on something that's not published like this, but are there any indications of systems where more than one object is transiting?
We have a lot of very interesting signals. One of the ones I liked when we first saw it was eclipsing binary with a little planet moving around it. So we had our first planet around eclipsing binary. Unfortunately, when we looked at that a little bit further, we found there were, believe it or not, two eclipsing binaries in the same very tiny field of view. So we see interesting signals, all sorts of interesting signals, but unless we've got confirming evidence, we really don't want to talk about what they might be.
All right, let's thank Bill again. We have a coffee break and then we convene at 11 a.m.